Vector field that you can find some measure of curvature but depend on the vector field.
I don't know. I guess I'm not sure I understand the question.
Vectors and vectors.
Yeah.
You could define them as anomaly.
Well, okay, so in my question, I was talking about vectors at different points. At infinitesimal distances. So in a sense, I'm not really talking about comparing vectors at distant points, although if you have the Lie transport, you could still think of transporting a vector along the curve to, yeah. So, yeah, so, well, yeah, then the argument would be you go along a closed curve, you see what you get when you get back, and I suppose there's no reason why this should be the same. And then the difference would define a notion of curvature. Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, it never occurred to me before, but I suppose, yeah. And I'm not sure what kind of curvature that would be and whether, as you say, it would be useful or not. Yeah, yeah, no, interesting question. I'm sure some, you know, you know, person really expert in differential geometry would have known what to say about this, but yeah, it's an interesting thought. Okay, so welcome to the rest of you. So before, so what I intend to do today is to get started with chapter two. But before I do that, I just wanted to go back to one final topic about chapter one, which I didn't talk about, and that has to do with local flatness. So I just want to talk about that a little bit before we get going. So I see that McMaster is with us. So can you see me all right, in McMaster? Okay, and I can hear you, so that's good news. So welcome to you, and so we'll get started with the lecture. So it's a well-known theorem of differential geometry that, you know, given a curved manifold, if you work locally, you can always introduce a coordinate patch in that very small neighborhood where everything looks flat. So the statement of the local flatness theorem is simply that, you know, you can find coordinates such that at a point P on your manifold, in that special coordinate system, the metric will be equal to the Minkowski metric, that's the minus one plus one plus one plus one matrix. And on top of that, you can also arrange for the first derivative of the metric at that point to be zero in that coordinate system. And that implies, obviously, that at that point, the Christoffel symbols will be zero as well. And that's still in that specialized coordinate system. And basically, that's all you can do. You could try to see if you can also force the second derivatives of the metric to be zero. And the answer is no. And that has to do with the fact that, well, in general, you have curvature on your manifold, and if you have curvature, that means that the second derivatives of the metric, while being related to the curvature tensor, cannot be forced to be zero. So that's essentially all that you can achieve. Now, in the notes, I have one way of proving this this result, and what I do is to, well, essentially construct a general coordinate transformation around the point P, and count, you know, the number of degrees of freedom that I have in my coordinate transformation, and verify that we can impose those 10 conditions here, and whatever number we have here, which would be 40. So you can impose all of those conditions at one point by looking at, you know, a coordinate transformation in the neighborhood of that point. And then if you continue that story, you find that once you've imposed those conditions, you're essentially done. You cannot impose additional conditions on your fourth transformation, and that's essentially why you cannot constrain the second derivative. That's one way of stating that you cannot constrain the second derivatives of the metric. But of course, a better way of saying that is that if your spacetime, if your manifold is curvature, then you cannot go beyond imposing those conditions. Now, this is, you know, I think, you know, fairly intuitive. I mean, if you think of us leaving the surface of the sphere on the scale of this room, things look pretty flat, so it's not terribly surprising that we can find a coordinate system that looks locally Cartesian. But as we try to expand that, you know, that coordinate system globally over the whole sphere, we fail. And, you know, that's the surface of the sphere being locally flat, but of course globally curved. So that's not terribly surprising. It's pretty familiar. It's a mathematical asset to have that because, you know, sometimes when you do a complicated tensorial calculation, it can really pay off big time to go to a specialized coordinate system that enforces those conditions. And if you can impose this at one point and that at one point, you know, there are lots of calculations where you can use that to your advantage and calculate the expression for a tensor in that coordinate system. And if you can relate that tensor to another tensor in that coordinate system and establish equality in that coordinate system, equality in one coordinate system for tensorial quantities is enough. And here you've done it the easy way, and you've established equality not just for that coordinate system, but for all coordinate systems. So it's often a very useful tool to, you know, to think about this. And I think there'll be occasions in this course where I'll use that. And I think in the section where I established the symmetries of the Riemann tensor, I actually used that trick. It's the quick way to get to the symmetries of the Riemann tensor to just go through a coordinate system where all of that is true. What I would like to do is to just you know, explore that a little bit more, and instead of talking formally in terms of coordinate transformations, what I would like to do is to display an expression for the metric that would be valid near a point P and would enforce those conditions. And that would be essentially constructing a specialized coordinate system that satisfies all of this, but we would also see where, you know, why we cannot extend those conditions to, you know, to more derivatives. And that's the idea of constructing what are known as Riemann normal coordinates in a neighborhood of some point P. So it's just an extension of those ideas that I think sort of give you more insight into the meaning of these things. So there's a set of coordinates that are called Riemann normal coordinates that exist around a point P, so they exist purely locally in the neighborhood of a point P, which display those features. And the Riemann normal coordinates, I'll tell you the meaning and how you construct them in a moment, but they have the property that in the Riemann normal coordinates, the metric, and I'll stop using star here, it's understood that we're dealing with the specialized coordinates, the metric can be expressed in that neighborhood around the point P as follows. At P directly, we have the Minkowski metric. But if we go away from P, we get corrections to that. And having this condition enforced means that there's going to be corrections to the metric that are going to be not linear in the displacement away from P, but they're going to start at quadratic order. And the corrections at quadratic order look like this. They involve a quantity, which is well known to us. Which in this context, the quantity over here is a bunch of constants. It's a constant tensor because what I have here is essentially the Riemann tensor associated with the metric evaluated at P. So think of this as a constant tensor, and it's the evaluation of the Riemann tensor for the whole spacetime at P in that coordinate system. And then, so those are the quadratic corrections, but then I could keep going and add additional corrections. It would be, you know, a cubic and quartic order and all of that stuff. I'll just display the schematic structure. There would be a cubic term that would involve gradients of the Riemann tensor evaluated at T, and this would involve an X cubed term. And then there would be an extra correction that would be, you know, quartic in the displacement away from P, and that would involve two derivatives of the Riemann tensor, but it would also involve Riemann tensor squared. So that's the schematic structure for the initial terms, and of course we could keep going and keep the expansion as accurate as we want it to be. So the point of all this, so R is a constant tensor, it has all the symmetries of the Riemann tensor, and the computation would reveal, if you plug in this metric into your favorite, you know, Riemann tensor calculator, and we'll do that calculation in just a second, a calculation would reveal that this constant tensor is in fact the Riemann tensor at P. If we wanted to calculate the Riemann tensor away from T, we would have to include more information. So the idea here is that if I want to calculate the Riemann tensor, the first thing I need to do is to calculate the Christoffel symbols. That means calculating a derivative, the first derivative of this. If I calculate the first derivative of this, I get rid of that because that's constant. And I'm going to get rid of one of those two powers of x. So now I have the Christoffel symbols starting at linear order in x, and I'm not keeping the extra term, so I only have the linear term in the expansion for the Christoffel symbols. When I calculate the Riemann tensor, I have two types of terms. I have derivatives of the Riemann tensor, of the Christoffel symbols. We'll get them from here at leading order, which means directly at p. And then we have the gamma squared terms, which are 0 at p. So that's how I can generate the Riemann tensor from the metric that I can only generate at p. And they're going to be given by these constant coefficients, right? All right. Okay. So that's the coordinate system. So the claim is that, you know, you can always construct a coordinate system such that the metric will be having this expansion. And obviously, while this is, you know, a sort of realization of the local flatness theorem, because at t, when x is equal to 0, the metric reduces to this. And if I calculate the Riemann, the Christoffel symbols, which we'll do in more detail in a second, well, we'll get a bunch of terms that will be starting at linear order in x, and p, of course, x is 0, and we get 0 for the first derivatives. But the second derivatives, of course, we get something from 0. And we can only get rid of those if the Riemann tensor vanishes at p. Okay, so I should say that p is described by x equals 0, so it's the origin of the coordinate system. Okay. Well, that's nice, but it would be nice to understand the nature of the coordinates and how do we construct those coordinates that satisfy these properties. And that's what I want to look a little bit into. And I'll go through that in a sort of roundabout way. So before I think of the meaning of the coordinates, what I would like to do is to look at the behavior of geodesics in that space-time, in that neighborhood described in that coordinate system. And by working this out, well, we'll learn some, you know, some techniques that are useful, but more than that, we'll identify the meaning of coordinates. And it turns out that, well, coordinates are really intimately tied to the behavior of geodesics, as we're going to see. One thing I wanted to say, though, before we get to that is the idea that, well, is the idea of, you know, tolerance and accuracy. I mean, if you want to do a calculation, if you want to, for example, model gravitational physics in this room, well, that's a bad example. Anyway, so what I wanted to say is that, you know, when we think of the local flatness theorem, mathematically, we're thinking of a statement that holds at a point. But physically, we're always thinking that if it holds at a point, probably it holds a little bit also around the point. So it's probably a good approximation to think the metric is being flat and the Christoffel symbols being 0, not just at one point, but in a neighborhood of that. The advantage of displaying this form for the metric is that now you have an idea of the error involved in making those sort of statements, and you have an idea of how accurate it is to think of those statements as applying to a neighborhood instead of just one point. And the idea here is that, well, here's a measure of the error that you make when you say that the metric is actually flat in the neighborhood of p. The Riemann tensor is something that has dimensions of 1 over x squared. So there's a length scale associated with the Riemann tensor. It's the radius of curvature of your space-time. And there's a length scale associated with x that tells you how far away you're going away from p. And what we have here is an error that's quadratic in the ratio of scales, you know, distance away from p divided by radius of curvature of the space-time. So if you're dealing with you know, a very weakly curved space-time, the radius of curvature is very large, the Riemann tensor is very low, and you have the freedom of going a fair ways away from P before you start noticing that this term plays a role. That's the idea of having two scales and having a small ratio of scales. So how far a neighborhood you can, how far is that neighborhood where you can make simply the approximation that G is equal to eta depends on how far you can go relative to the rate of curvature. So if you're in a strongly curved space-time, you can still make this approximation, but now your neighborhood is very restricted. In a strongly curved space-time, the rate of curvature is small, the Riemann tensor is large, and the neighborhood over which you can assume flatness to high accuracy becomes much smaller. So it's still true that locally you have freedom, but what you mean by locally depends on the scales involved. And that's represented in that term over here. So depending on how much accuracy you want in your calculation and how much you're willing to tolerate and all of that, you can choose to either include this term or neglect it. Or if you really want high accuracy, you can choose to include this and perhaps include a few more until you've reached, a tolerance level that you're, willing to tolerate. So that's getting turning a mathematical statement into something looser but more physical. But that always comes with an epsilon, which here is the ratio of scales. And depending on which power of epsilon you can tolerate to be small, tells you how many terms you need to include in the expansion. So I think I'm coming back to a point that you raised with me last time. So what's really the validity of that local flatness statement? Okay. So let's look at the GDs that's associated with that space-time. So I'll be solving the GDs equation. And in order to do that, I'll need to work out the Christoffel symbols. And so let's go through the calculation of the Christoffel symbols for that metric. And essentially, all I have to do is to evaluate the first derivative of the metric and then combine them in the appropriate, combination of terms. And we'll see what we get. So if I want to calculate the Christoffel symbols in my neighborhood, what I have to do is to compute, well, first of all, I'll need to work out the inverse metric. And then I need to work out this combination of quantities over here. So the first thing I need to do is to work out the first derivative of the metric. And here, the best we can do is to work out the Christoffel symbols to first order. If we're going to keep only the second order term of the metric after differentiating, will be at first order. And that's the best we can do unless we keep track of the extra terms in the expansion. So we'll be working at first order. A nice feature about this is that once we have this at first order, there's no need to keep track of the second order corrections to that. They're going to be irrelevant. So it's going to be enough to work this to first order, but there's no first order term to that because the correction to the metric is second order. The correction to the inverse metric also will be of second order. So all we need here is the inverse metric to leading order, which is a Minkowski metric. So this is easy. This is not that bad. So let's work out, for example, this component right here. We have to differentiate g mu beta gamma, starting from that expression over from the metric. R is a constant quantity, so we only have to worry about the explicit factors of x that are contained in that equation. So what we need to do is to differentiate with respect to gamma the term minus third, and now we have to be sure that we transpose the indices properly. So the first index is mu. The second index is the summation index, I'll call it lambda. The second index, beta, appears here, so I'll call that beta. And then we have another summation index, I'll call that rho. And we have x lambda, x rho, plus additional terms that I don't worry about. So we have to differentiate that with respect to gamma. And while differentiating x, x lambda with respect to x gamma, produces either 0 or 1, depending on whether lambda agrees with gamma. So this is something I can express as, so I factorize the constant Riemann term over here, then differentiate x gamma with respect to x, x lambda with respect to x gamma, and I get a Kronecker delta, lambda gamma. and X rho is left alone, and then I have the X lambda and the delta rho gamma. And then what I get after getting rid of deltas is R mu gamma beta rho X rho minus a third R mu lambda beta, rho beta gamma X lambda. So here I change rho into gamma. And I'm not going to leave it at that because I can simplify the expression a little bit by making sure that I factorize X rho and X lambda. So what I can do is to relabel this dummy index so that it's not, so what I'll do is to change this rho into a lambda, and I'll do it here. And in this way, I can just factorize the X lambda. So just to get a cleaner expression, it's a good idea to sort of consolidate the notation a little bit. And what I'll do is to rewrite the whole thing in this way, using lambda as the as the dummy index in both cases. And that's an expression for, well, the derivative of the metric expanded the first order in X. So now I'll just go through the rest of the steps to get gamma. So all we have to do is to, well, work it out here, work it out here. But of course, all we have to do is to permute the indices. We have to be a little bit careful doing that. So the rest of the steps are pretty straightforward. And I have to make a mistake along the way, but I don't think so. OK, so let's just combine all the terms. So the Christoff symbol is going to be given. So there's going to be a factor of 1/2. And there's also going to be a factor of minus a third. It's going to be common to all the terms. The inverse metric, we've agreed, we can just work out at leading order, which means that we're dealing with the inverse Minkowski metric. So I'll just leave it at that. And now we have all the terms that come from the metric derivatives. So we already have two of them over here. And the next group of terms will come from the second term over here. And I get them by interchanging gamma and beta in this expression right here. So this is beta gamma. Here we have gamma beta. So all I have to do is to permute the gammas and the betas. So in the second set of terms, we have R mu beta gamma lambda plus R mu lambda gamma beta. And then for the last combination of terms here, we have to be a little bit more careful because we have to sort of slide the indices around. So let's see if I can do that. So the first index in the Riemann tensor here corresponds to the first index in the metric term. And here, that first index is beta. So the first term over here is beta. The second index that appears here is the derivative index, and that's mu. So we have that. Beta, the third index, is the second index in the metric that has become gamma. And lambda is the summation index, so I'll leave that alone. And finally, I get the other term by permuting the third and the second and fourth indices. So for the last term, I get minus R. So I commute the second and fourth indices. So I get beta lambda gamma mu. And all of that multiply X lambda. So you know, nothing very difficult about all this. You just have to keep the indices straight. And that's probably the source number one of errors in any tensorial calculation. You just do this index permutation business incorrectly, and you end up with the wrong answer. There's a strong chance that I've made mistakes here. And of course, you're keeping track of all that, and you'll let me know if I did. So, no mistakes. No, good. Well, we'll see. OK. So are there possibilities of simplification here? I believe so. For example, when I look at this term and that term, I notice that they differ by position of the last two indices, but I remember the Riemann tensor is antisymmetric over those last two indices. Here I'm taking the symmetric combination, and symmetric combination is zero. So this goes away with that. What else? Well, I don't think we can touch those two. Can we do something better? Well, I think so, because we still have symmetries at our disposal. When I look at that term and I look at this term, I see that the first thing that we did, so to get that term from this term, I have to change this pair of indices for that pair of indices. So I switch those pairs of indices around. And then on top of that, I switch. So I leave this pair alone, but I've switched the order of that pair. So if you follow all of that, you'll conclude that this term is actually equal to that term, including the minus sign. So we get twice the result. So just to repeat this, symmetry of Riemann's answer is where you take this pair of indices and this pair of indices, and you switch them around. You get the same thing back. And then if you leave this ordering alone, which we have, and you switch this ordering, you get minus sign. By doing those operations, we end up with that. Or undoing those operations, we turn this into another node. So we get a factor of two and we get twice that term. And I think the same story happens here. Here it's even simpler because I can get that term directly by switching this pair of indices and we get rid of the minus sign. So that's the point that's worthwhile making. When you manipulate Riemann tensors, you have to always do that, and typically you produce dramatic simplifications in the calculation. If you don't do that, and you were to propagate this to a long calculation, you would generate thousands of terms needlessly. Here, if you boil it down first, of course, you have a much smaller expression to manipulate and less chance of making a mistake. So bottom line is that you have our expression for the Christoffel symbols, and they're not that bad. We got rid of this 1/2 by multiplying everything by 2. And we have the Minkowski metric that I'll just use here to raise the index on the Riemann tensor. Because I'm working first order in x, there's no distinction between raising with a true inverse metric or the approximate one. The difference would only appear at higher order. So just to keep the notation cleaner, I'll use this to raise the index here. And we have R alpha gamma beta lambda plus R alpha beta gamma lambda multiplying x lambda. It's understood that we're proceeding, that this is the leading term in the expansion. And if the world is kind, I agree with myself, and I do, so that's good. So those are the Christoffel symbols. And well, I won't do the rest of it, but if you want to calculate the Riemann tensor and check that those quantities that I started with are really the components of the Riemann tensor evaluated P, all you would have to do is to calculate an extra derivative on the Christoffel symbols. You would get rid of this factor of lambda, which means of x lambda, which means that you would get something which starts leading order and doesn't keep track of the higher order corrections. And then when you substitute this into the usual expression for the Riemann tensor, you would calculate this combination of terms. You wouldn't worry about those terms because at p or at x equals 0, they're all 0. And by doing this calculation, you would verify that the Riemann tensor surely at p is equal to this set of quantities right here. So I'll leave that for you to do in your own time. After what we've done here, it's a very straightforward exercise that illustrates the, as you do this calculation, you're going to have, again, to look at all the possible permutation of indices that will, probably turn the collection of four terms into a single term. You have to, it's a good exercise to sort of go through the idea of using the symmetries of the Riemann tensor to simplify the result. Okay, so why did I want the Christoffel symbols? The reason why I want them is to actually use them to solve the geodesic equation. So that's what I want to do. So I want to examine the geodesic equation near P. And what's the geodesic equation? Well, now I'm looking to solve a bunch of differential equations for the description of the geodesic. And I'll use an affine parameterization. So I'll want to solve that equation right here. And we're going to keep track of this linear order, which means that we're not going to try to solve the equation in general. We're going to try to solve the equation, as an expansion around P. So I'll use the dot. So just for concreteness, I'll think of space-like geodesic, but we'll be talking about time-like geodesic or even a null geodesic. It makes no difference. But speaking of space-like geodesic, I'll use proper distance as the parameter. So x dot will stand for a derivative of the position of the curve with respect to proper distance. So s is proper distance. So the picture is something like this. We have, we have T over here. We have neighborhood in which we can, reliably use our expansions. And I'm looking at a geodesic that's going to start out from P and go somewhere. And I want to describe where it goes in that coordinate system. And one thing that I know is that, so S is going to be the distance away from P. And when S is equal to 0, X is going to be equal to 0. And the way to solve this equation, just to make it easy, is to consider that the solution has to be, can be expressed as a Taylor expansion in S. I can write down power series in S, and that should be good enough to try to solve the equation. So the first thing that I'll say is that so there's an expansion in powers of S. There's no term at of order one because it's understood that the geodesic starts at S. So the first order correction will involve, so the first term of the expansion will be a first order in S, and then there will be a second order correction and perhaps a third order correction, but of course we won't proceed that far. But that's, because I'm picking in the neighborhood of P, it's good enough to postulate a series expansion of that form. And the point here is that the vector N, the vector A, the vector B are constant vectors because, this is a Taylor expansion about P. So N alpha, A alpha, B alpha, and the other ones are all constant vectors. And we can think of them as being evaluated at P. Okay, so that's the postulated form for the geodesic equation. And I want to know what N is, I want to know what A is, and I want to know what B is. Well, N is going to be determined by some conditions, right? To specify the geodesic uniquely, I have to tell you where it starts and in which direction it's going. So N is going to be specifying the direction in which it's going, and we've already decided that the geodesic starts at T. So from conditions, which is X dot, so we know that X at T is 0, and we also know that X dot at T, well, the derivative of X at P is going to be N plus 0, because all the terms are going to be 0 at T. That's going to be denoted N, and that's something that we won't be able to fix because that's determined by conditions. By solving the geodesic equation, however, we should be able to pin down what those extra vectors are. And as we carry more terms in the expansion, starting with the metric, and then with the soft symbols, we'll be able to determine more accurately what all these additional terms are. So that's the calculation I want to do. I want to determine A and B. Well, B I want to determine. Can I determine B? No, I can't determine B because I can work only the first order. That's it. No, I can determine B. So we'll see how it turns out. Okay, so I have the description of my geodesic in terms of unknown quantities. So if I differentiate that relation, I get that's the leading order, the velocity is n, but then we get 2s a plus 3s squared b plus higher order correction. So that's the expansion for the velocity. And the acceleration is going to be, we get rid of that, we get 2a plus 6s plus higher order terms. And the point is that now I want to plug everything into the duties equation. I have the x double dot term expanded to first order in s. I have stops both expanded to first order in s because they've been expanded to first order in x. So if I carry all the terms to first order, I should be able to determine everything that I've talked about. So let's do it. So let's just do the plug-in. So in the duties equation, on the left-hand side, we get 0. And what we get first is 2a plus 6sb plus a bunch of corrections. In the Christoffel simples, what we're supposed to do here, well, these are a bunch of constants. The Riemann tensor evaluated the p. I have to plug in the expansion for the metric. But here, I only, have information about the leading order term. So here I'll plug in the expansion also at leading order. So the first, so I plug in for the Christoffel symbols and I get b minus a third Riemann. So now I have to worry about the indices are correct. That's good. We have Riemann r alpha gamma beta lambda plus r alpha beta gamma lambda. And x lambda, well, I'll use the expansion and re-express as S M lambda. And I have to stop here. I'm at first order in S, which is the accuracy of the calculation. And then this, I multiply by X dot. But here I have a term that's already at first order. So X dot has to be kept at leading order. So I have N alpha plus directions. It's beta at this case. Multiply and again. And the point here is that now I have an expansion for the duties equation active to first order in S, but not part of that, and have everything that I need to be accurate at first order. All right, well, simplify this a little bit. We get 2a. And I'm going to group all the terms at order S. And first I get 6b. And then I get the Riemann tensor terms. I get minus third r alpha gamma beta lambda plus r alpha beta gamma lambda. Multiplying n, and I would have higher order terms that I'd control. The left hand side is 0, the right hand side has to be 0 at its order in S. Our first conclusion is that A has to be 0. When we looked at the term in first order in S, well, we looked at the Riemann tensor terms, and perhaps you can see that those are 0. Who could see that? One person can see that. The rest of you are on, so that two people can see that. The reason why the Riemann tensor terms actually drop out of the calculation is because of that asymmetry property of the Riemann tensor. Look at those two indices, beta and lambda. The Riemann tensor is asymmetric in those two indices, but here we have symmetric combination of lambda and beta. This quantity is symmetric under an exchange of lambda and beta. This is asymmetric. Whenever you multiply the symmetric thing with symmetric thing, you get 0. That happens here. That happens here also, because here's gamma and lambda, which is asymmetric, and we have gamma and lambda here being in the symmetric combination. So those terms don't contribute. So all of that is 0 by symmetry of Riemann. And we conclude that the linear term S involves only B, and B has to be 0. So what do we have? Well, we have a very simple conclusion, which is to say that alpha at B and A, the vectors, are 0. And what that means is that our description of geodesics in our neighborhood in that board system is simply this plus terms that have to be at least a fourth order in S to produce any noticeable correction. If I kept more terms in my metric, and if I kept more terms in my self symbols, and if I included an additional term in my Taylor expansion of the geodesic description, I would be able to calculate this, and I would find zero. And if I calculate at all orders, I would continue to find zero. So what's the point of all this? Well, if you look at this equation, mathematically, you have a bunch of straight lines. You have constant direction, and you have the position vector that's linear in the distance away from the point. Those are straight lines. And the point is that this is actually the straight line. So if you were to introduce Riemann normal coordinates at all orders, this would be the exact description of geodesics that originate from P. Well, that's great, isn't it? I mean, we get straight lines for our geodesics. Is that a surprise? Well, maybe. Is that an accident? No. The Riemann normal coordinates are defined precisely to enforce that that result. So the way to actually construct Riemann normal coordinates to actually come up with a coordinate transformation is simply to analyze the behavior of geodesics in the original coordinate system, and then introduce the coordinate transformation that will make those geodesics straight. The geodesics will not be straight in whatever original coordinate system you were given. You straighten them out by introducing the right coordinate transformation, and those by definition, and that coordinate transformation by definition gives you Riemann normal coordinates. So Riemann normal coordinates are designed to simplify the description of geodesics, which are then straight lines. To me, that's a very beautiful construction. I mean, there's something very nice about this. And as you as you find sources on Riemann normal coordinates, you have various ways of actually constructing them. That can be very pretty. So here I've done it in a very pedestrian way. I've started the answer to illustrate the feature, but the way it would be done in practice, or if you had to start from the beginning, would be to start from that description, and you would have constructed the metric in accordance to that. That I find very pretty. But anyway, the point remains that you have very nice implementation of the local flatness theorem in the Riemann normal coordinates, and also you have very intuitive picture of what these coordinates mean. They're simply direct coordinates to give you the simplest possible description of geodesics as straight lines. And given the fact that metric is flat to good accuracy, it's not surprising that the geodesics would be flat, would be straight to high accuracy in that coordinate system. The wonderful feature, though, is the fact that even if you include corrections, you don't have to modify the description of the geodesics. The metric, the form of the metric, is such that the description is going to be straight to all orders. So those are Riemann normal coordinates, and there's a variation on that theme that can also be explored. For example, there's a way of extending the local flatness theorem from a point to a complete geodesic. You can actually think of yourself as a free-falling observer in space-time following a geodesic in your vicinity, by the principle of equivalence, but also by differential geometry in the vicinity of that geodesic. You have local flatness, and you can display, you can write down a metric that will have a feature of being Minkowski everywhere on the geodesic, and have Kristoff symbols that are also zero everywhere on the geodesic. And then as you go away from the geodesic, you start generating corrections to the metric that are quadratic in the distance away from the geodesic. As you travel along the geodesic, everything remains true. But as you go away from the geodesic, you start generating Riemann tensor terms that appear at quadratic coordinates. So those, in that construction, you're not dealing with Riemann normal coordinates because those refer to a point. If you want to refer to an entire geodesic, those are different coordinates that are called Fermi normal coordinates. And that's the same Fermi of the quantum mechanics Fermi, the nuclear physics Fermi, point where he actually did general relativity, and he had a great contribution of introducing that fourth system that is locally flat, not just to the point, but along the full geodesic. And if you read, if you read notes, the final section of chapter one is an explicit construction of Fermi-Null affordance, and that also I find very pretty. I'll want to say that the way I do it in the book is, it's really the hard way. There are much better ways of doing that that I learned after the fact. So, you know, forgive me if you're studying that section. It's not as easy. The presentation is not as transparent as it could have been. Okay. So, any questions about any of that? Yep.
Correct. You know that is with the equivalence principle.
Okay, so the equivalence principle, at least the way I tend to state it, local flatness at point doesn't
really have anything to do with the principle of equivalence. This is just a statement of differential geometry. The statement of the principle of equivalence, at least in the way I like to think about it, is that this statement that I mentioned just before, which is to say that if you're free falling in space-time, you feel no effect of gravity. And in your immediate neighborhood, you also don't see any effect of gravity. The only effect of gravity that you could ever see would be produced by tidal forces. And in order to see those, you have to have either extremely strong curvature or a fairly large neighborhood. So if you're falling toward Earth in an enclosed spaceship, then you do experiments by throwing balls around. Everything in your lab is falling down to the same acceleration. So relative to you in your lab, you don't see any local effect of gravity. So that's the conclusion, that in a local neighborhood, freely falling in a gravitational field, you can remove gravity. There is no such thing as gravity in that immediate neighborhood. If you do it somewhere else, you can do the same. But globally, of course, there's a discrepancy between the view in this frame and the view in that frame. And those are due to tidal forces. So the statement that you can set the metric to its Minkowski value on geodesic, and also set the connection to zero on that geodesic, to me is a mathematical state of principle equivalence. That's just saying that locally in that input you don't have gravity. And the only manifestation of gravity that you have comes from the Riemann term that occurs in second order. And there you go back to those statements I made about the ratio of scales. If your neighborhood is very small, if your lab is very small, or if the scale of curvature is very large, then you don't see those tidal effects. And as far as you're concerned, there's a threat. That's my idea of it.
Physical rods and clocks, so that the straight line thing is a sustained principle of inertia.
How do you physically realize a system of coordinates? You have to use rods and clocks, and certainly I'm happy to include that in the discussion. So I don't think there's a contradiction there, right?
Yes, I'm assuming that a rod will be able to measure proper distance, and a clock will be able to measure proper time.
That's an interesting thought. So, proper distance later. I'm afraid I'll say something stupid. Okay, other questions?
We're talking over here about because of the radius of curvature, that term, the one-third, kind of represents an error when you move away from the peak. But somewhere along the way, there when we have limited to the Riemann term because of the anti-centralization, we kind of lost that information. And maybe I'm not really clear on what our sort of straight lines mean, but it seems that those don't really depend on any kind of radius of curvature. That the corrections don't really appear until the fourth order of proper distance, no matter what.
Don't make it period. So, if all I'm interested in is to give a description of geodesics going away from P, I would guess straight lines to all orders in S. Okay. But
the metric is the more information.
That metric is a way of identifying 2D shapes, but it's also a way of measuring distances. It's all, I mean, there's a lot of geometric information that's encoded in the metric that's not necessarily encoded in the behavior of 2D shapes. And for those other purposes, the rebound term plays a role, and the additional corrections also play a role.
What do you mean by that? I mean, because if your first expression says there's order S to perform.
Okay, okay, I didn't make this clear enough. All I'm saying is that here I have to have that input. So based on that calculation, I can only conclude that this is the description of 19b6 up to terms that will control the expansion. And I had to stop here because I only started from a
metric that had two, that had quadratic terms in it. And, you know, after everything is done, I don't control those terms. The statement I was trying to make is that if I kept more terms in the metric, if I included all of that and perhaps, you know, 20 additional terms to go to, you know, to order 20, let's say, if I repeated that calculation to all of those orders, including, you know, including all the information in the metric, I would conclude that at each order I get zero. And so to any prescribed order, you get zero, and then I push it to all orders, I get zero to all orders.
It's certainly not obvious from
this calculation, because it seems to happen by accident, right? And the other point I was trying to make is that, well, you know, that's sort of the pedestrian sort of stupid way of doing this. If you're going to be interested in constructing green polynomial coordinates, you're going to say my first requirement is GD6 are straight fault orders, and you're going to come up with a coordinate transformation that straighten out GD6 to the prescribed order at which you put, then you will figure out what metric needs to look like in order to make that true. So in the more advanced way of constructing Riemann number four coordinates, you really introduce the GD6 first, and then you you find a way of you know, of making them straight by producing the right port transformation. Yep.
If I understood correctly, you were implying that this basically had to do not so much physics, but with just differential geometry.
Right.
The Fermi coordinates, the fact that you can do that around a freely falling body seems to imply the equivalence principle, and therefore statistics, in addition to just differential geometry. So, I've not looked at the derivation of the Fermi coordinates yet, but is there a distinction in terms of what arises in that derivation as opposed to this one?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And I think
Professor Brown might have something to say about this, but the way I would try to answer it is this. So, the statement that I made about Fermi normal coordinates, the statement that along the geodesic in a curved manifold, you can set the metric values to Minkowski and the Christoffel symbols to zero on a full geodesic, that's difficult geometry. There's no physics at this level. Where the physics enters is the statement that if you want to form a theory of gravity that incorporates the principle of equivalence, it will have to be a metric theory of gravity, with probably some extra conditions placed on the connection to make it a Christoffel connection, as opposed to some other type of connection. So the fact that you would want your gravity to the fact that you want a theory of gravity that does satisfy the principle of equivalence takes you to a metric theory of gravity. And when you have that, you have mathematics to back you up. That's the way I see the connection. But I must confess, I've thought about this recently very carefully, so there's probably logical ramifications that I don't appreciate.
We can talk about that. All right, so
let's move on. Now I want to go into chapter two, and we'll still be talking about geodesics in chapter two, but I want to use Riemann normal coordinates. And before I get into material, let me just tell you where I intend to go with this. Ultimately, I want to talk about congruences of null geodesics, and I'll tell you what I mean by congruences in just a moment. But essentially, I want to introduce a whole network of null geodesics, and the reason why I want to get there is because, well, it's going to be part of our description of event horizons. An event horizon is an all hypersurface, you know, the surface from which photons do not escape. You can think of an all hypersurface as being something generated by GPSics. And they're now 2D6, and if we want to study the event horizon, we have to study null hypersurfaces. If we want to do that, we have to study the generators of the null hypersurface, which are those null 2D6. So the tools I want to introduce, you know, concerning null 2D6 are going to be very essential to a discussion of the event horizon later on in the course. So I need to introduce all of this, but it turns out that null 2D6 are subtle by their fact that they're light-like as opposed to space-like time-like. And before I tackle those subtleties, I want to be on really firm ground to talk about time-like GPSics. So first, we'll study the mathematics of a congruence of time-like 2D6, and then you know, we'll work it all out. And you know, that has some interest in it, you know, in its own right, and we'll see some interesting applications of that. But you know, that's the stepping stone to do now 2D6 in the view to have the right tools to study event horizons. Before I get to confluences, I would like to illustrate some of the aspects in a way that I will be illuminating. And the way I'll do that is to talk a little bit about fluid mechanics. And I'm hoping that you've studied fluid mechanics a little bit so that this will actually help. If you haven't, or if it doesn't help, well, just bear with me for a little while, and then we'll go back to the more, you know, traditional differential geometry view on this topic. So let me turn to that. Just put my notes away here. Part of the discussion will turn the energy conditions, and I was asking you last week to read the section on energy conditions. I won't spend too much time on that, but when we encounter them, I'll say more words about them. Okay. So let's go back to very Newtonian things, and think of describing the behavior of fluid.
Where's the?
So that's the prelude to chapter 2. Fluid mechanics. And the reason why I'm doing this is because, you know, in the context of a simpler physical situation, at least for me it's simpler, we can introduce all of the language that we're going to be using in the context of congruences. So I'll be introducing things like the expansion, shear, and rotation of a congruence. I think this can all be understood at a sort of elementary level by thinking about fluids. So let's imagine we have fluid, and this is my blob fluid at some instant of time. We're going to have a fluid of density rho. Density would be a function of position and time, position within fluid, and the fluid, of course, will have the velocity field that depends on time and also depend on position within fluid. And what I want to do is to look at fluid from the point of view of a given fluid element. We're going to pick fluid element, we're going to color it red, and we're going to sit on it and look at what happens around it. So here's my reference fluid element. And while in the global view, of course, this fluid element would be moving in the fluid with, you know, a velocity that would be given by the velocity field at that position. But what I want to do is to introduce a relative description relative to that reference fluid element. So we're going to be sitting on it and look at what happens around it. So this is a reference fluid element. and it's going to be at some position that's not in the fluid, and it's going to be moving with velocity v evaluated v naught at x naught. Here's a neighboring fluid out, and I want to look at what happens here relative to what happens here. So this is the fluid element at position x1. And what interests me in this discussion is the deviation factor between the fluid elements. So this is, you know, I don't know what to call it. It's a, you know, a neighboring fluid element. So this one we've called red. We're sitting on it. This one we're coloring blue, and we're looking at it sitting on the red one. And I've deduced c, which is going to be a function of time. And that's going to be, well, the difference between the position of the neighboring element relative to the position of the reference element. That's what I'm about. And what I want to do is to keep track of what c is doing as a function of time. This is the deviation vector. And if I want to study what happens in neighboring, you know, in a neighborhood around my reference fluid element, well, all that information is going to be encoded in C. So how this other fluid element moves in time around the reference fluid element, all that information is contained in that deviation vector. And that's the point of view I want to study in a way that would be, you know, compatible with what we know about fluid mechanics. Okay. So what I'm trying to do here is to, you know, essentially work out theory of how that C should be evolved in time. I won't do any dynamics here. I'll just leave it at level of kinematics. Okay. So so this is a moment of time. So we have to think that fluid as evolving in time. But whatever we do, we continue to sit on that fluid element, so it's moving, but we continue to sit on it. And we're looking at what happens in the neighborhood. And one question we want to ask is, well, how does that vector change with time? So we're sitting here, we have this other fluid element that's been colored in blue, and we keep track of it. And we look at it as a fluid evolves in time, and sometimes this guy will get closer, this guy will get farther apart, you know. So all sorts of things can happen, and again, we're keeping track of all this through the deviation vector. And what I want to do is to write down an equation for the evolution of that deviation vector. And all I have to tell you, of course, is that, well, this is the relative velocity between the fluid elements. So it's going to be the difference between the velocity fields evaluated at each point. So it's going to be the difference between the velocity field evaluated at x1 minus the velocity field evaluated at x0. So this is the velocity of the blue element. This is the velocity of the red element. And that really is the relative velocity. And relative velocity, of course, has to be the rate of change of the relative position vector. So nothing very deep about that. In fact, there's nothing very deep about anything I'm going to say here, except that it's a good way of introducing the stuff that we're going to be doing later in the context of congruences. Okay, I'll write some components, and I'll introduce an approximation where the deviation vector is supposed to be small. So in components, I'll use the Latin index to denote spatial index. We have the difference between the velocity at x1 and the velocity at x0. But of course, x1 is x0 plus the deviation vector. And if the deviation vector is small, I can Taylor expand that, and I'll Taylor expand the first order in the deviation vector. And of course, I'll get rid of the leading term. And what I'll get is the gradient of the velocity field multiplied by the deviation vector to leading order, but that's good enough for what I want to do. So bottom line is that this description where we only focus on the neighborhood of our reference element, how the fluid behaves around it is encoded in this, and well, that behavior is determined by the way that the velocity changes in that neighborhood. So it's the velocity gradient that that is important. So I'll write this expression in slightly different terms. I'll just say that the rate of change of the deviation vector is sub matrix B times the displacement vector itself. I'll trunk this in this leading order. And of course, the matrix B is obtained by taking a derivative of the velocity field. Well, if I wanted to say more than this and analyze the reasons why the velocity field is changing, I would have to look at the acceleration field. I would have to look at the stresses that, you know, force acting in a fluid. I'm not interested in that. All I want to know is to analyze the nature of that matrix and see all the possible types of motion that can arise. The first thing that I'll say is that this matrix DAB is going to be a general 3x3 matrix. I mean, this quantity here doesn't have any particular symmetries. So we're dealing here with a general 3x3 matrix. And the point is that when you're dealing with a general 3x3 matrix in this context, it's always a good idea to break it down into irreducible pieces that are smaller and simpler. And here I'm going to do it in this context. We'll do it again in the context of congruences. And that's where the idea of expansion, shear, and rotation enters. So BAB is a general 3x3 matrix. It has 9 components. And I want to essentially group the components into smaller pieces that I'll call irreducible pieces. So here's how I'm going to do. So let's talk about the matrix B. That's my symbolic notation for the matrix itself. The first thing that you do when you want to decompose a matrix is to split it to symmetric and antisymmetric pieces. So let's do that. How many components in an antisymmetric 3x3 matrix? 3. So we have 3 independent components here. And this symmetric means that we have 6, so we have 9. So that's good. We're going to do one more step. We're going to decompose the symmetric piece into something that I'll call the trace part, and what's left over, which is going to be symmetric trace free. What I mean by trace part is that it's going to be a component that's going to be proportional to the identity matrix. And what's left is going to be, well, everything else that was left over. And that piece, of course, will have 0 trace. So we're going to have 1 component here, 5 components here, 3 components here. And we have our, 9 inch components. Okay, so how do I want to write this? Mathematically, I'll write it as third times quantity theta times the identity matrix. That's the trace part. The third is there because I want theta to be the trace of B. And the trace of the identity matrix is 1, is 3. So that's going to be the first part. The symmetric trace 3 part is going to be some matrix that I'll call sigma. And the antisymmetric part is going to be denoted only. That's just the station. So that is the trace part. This is the symmetric trace 3 part, STS. And this is the antisymmetric part. And the notation and then the terminology is that theta is going to be known as the expansion, or if you call it the expansion rate, it would be better. And we're going to understand what that is in a moment. Sigma is called shear tensor. And omega is called rotation tensor. And I want to explain why we call these things that. And in components, what we have is that DAB is going to be a third theta delta AB plus sigma AB plus OBF AB. And, well, I should perhaps count the components. We have one component right here. This is what's left over from symmetric matrix when I remove the trace. So we go from 6 minus 1, we have 5. And here we have 3. So in total, we still have, you know, the 9 original components. So why do we do this? Well, the idea is that we broke down B into smaller pieces and can individually understand what each piece is doing. And then, well, the general motion is going to be the sum of all possible broken down motions. So if we understand how this works and how this works and how this works separately, you know, the general motion is going to be just the superposition of all the possible effects. And that's where I want to go now, to understand why this represents an overall expansion of the fluid, why this represents, you know, shearing of fluid without change in volume, and why this really corresponds to vorticity or rotation of the fluid. One thing you can say right away is that, well, theta is recognized here as the trace of the matrix B, because this is designed to be trace-free. The trace, of course, the diagonal components of the symmetric matrix are zero, so that has zero trace. But we remember that B is the gradient of V, which means that I'm talking here about the divergence of the vector field. And those of you who are experts in fluid mechanics will recognize the divergence of V as a measure of the rate of change of density in the fluid, or rate of change of specific volume in density. Is that obvious to all of you, or should I go through an argument about that? I'll go through it because, you know, it's pretty central to our discussion for a good portion of the course. So why expansion? So let's talk about expansion. Well, I'll recall a few of the key equations in fluid mechanics. So if we have density in a vector field and a velocity field, we have the continuity equation, which is the usual statement of continuity that applies in all sorts of different areas, including electromagnetism. So we have, you know, in the context of fluid mechanics, this is a statement of mass conservation. If you were to think with electromagnetism, this would be the charge density, this would be the charge, the current density of you know, electric charge, and this would represent conservation of charge. So that equation, I think, is familiar. When I talk about the expansion, I'll put it in terms of density first. When I talk about the expansion, I'm sitting on my fluid element, and I want to look at how the density in that input is changing with time. And I'll relate, you know, so think of fluid element as containing some mass. That mass is not going to change because we do have conservation of mass. What changes is density, and the reason why density changes is because, well, the volume, the specific volume of that fluid element will change. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between a change in density and a change in volume. And that's what I want to keep track of, because the conclusion that I want to reach is that theta, the quantity over here, measures the rate at which the volume changes. So I'll calculate the change in density. But the point is that we want to calculate the change in density as we follow the fluid element. And in fluid mechanics, there's a derivative associated with that, and it's called the convective derivative sometimes. Anyway, if I want to calculate the rate of change of rho following a volume element, following a fluid element, what we're constructing is not the partial time derivative of the density, because that would be the change in density if I stand still in the coordinate system while the fluid itself is moving. If I want to follow the fluid element as the fluid moves, I have to account for time changes, but I also have to account for the spatial changes, because the fluid element is changing its position as I follow its motion. So the rate of change of rho following the fluid element is normally called, well, the total time derivative of density. And that accounts for partial time changes of density, but it also accounts for the spatial changes through this term right here that involves the spatial gradients and velocity. That's where I think you've seen this before, and this was reasonably familiar. If it's not familiar, one thing to think about this is to think that derivative on the right side as being the derivative along the word line of density. If you have word line in space-time, we can use that word here, even though it's Newtonian. We have tangent vector, u alpha, which is going to be, partial ddt, using time here as the parameter of the word line. And, you know, when we say that we want to calculate the change of the density along the word line, typically we want to calculate this. That's what Volkes meant when we said, let's calculate the change of something in the direction of the word line. We've always said, well, it's the derivative of rho in the direction of the density vector associated with the word line. In this situation, u alpha would have the one time component because t is the parameter. And spatial components would be the ordinate velocity vector. So when you actually compute this, well, perhaps you didn't know what you're actually computing, precisely that. So what's that? Well, we're following the word line a few of them, and so the convective derivative is just precisely that derivative, and of course it has to account for each term. Okay, so I've probably belabored that point way too much. Okay. Well, let's put the two equations together. So this is the thing that I want to keep track of. And what I can do is to use the information from the continuity equation to evaluate that term. So there's a couple of extra steps here. But they're very simple. And let's go through them. So if I expand the continuity equation, I get the partial t derivative. And then while I have the divergence of a product, so the first thing I need to do is to differentiate rho at v alone. So I get v dot rho, v dot derivative of rho. And then I leave rho alone, and I differentiate v. And that's what we get. It's a full statement of the continuity equation. And what I see is that those terms are what are the rest of the convective derivative. So what I conclude from this is that the convective derivative of the density as a fault of the fluid element is minus, those two terms that we're talking about. So we get that term. And we get the divergence of the beacon. So what does that tell us? It tells us that the rate of change, the fractional rate of change of density as we follow the fluid element is given by the divergence of the vector field, of the velocity field. So this is the change in density that I measure if I follow the fluid element. And if I were to say that the density is just the specific mass of the fluid element divided by its specific fluid, if I keep the mass inside the fluid element constant, the density changes because the volume changes. And if you put it all together, what you'll find is that the fractional change of volume around the fluid element is governed by the divergence of the vector field, and that's the quantity that I call theta. So what's theta mean? Theta is a measure of fractional rate of change of volume around the reference fluid element. All right. Okay. Well, I have maybe 5 minutes, so I'll just go through the a quick discussion of what shear and rotation means, and I don't think that will require too much time. So I need those equations over here. So let's think about it physically first. We're sitting on our fluid element, we're looking at our neighborhood, and we see that, well, the fluid is moving. And now we see that if the fluid motion comes with a change in density or a change in specific volume, this is in fact represented by theta. But we can think of other ways by which fluid can move. It can change. So if we sort of draw a shape around our, so if we start at t equals zero, and we identify all the fluid elements around us, within a circle or within a sphere, then we could look at how the sphere is going to change in time. The shape of the sphere is going to change in time. And what I want to justify and illustrate is the fact that the shear tensor over here, as we follow how the sphere evolves, will produce a change in the shape of the sphere. The volume is going to be squashed. We've already accounted for the changes in volume by that quantity. So this will describe squashing of the sphere without changing the volume. So we just change the shape. The sphere will become an ellipsoid, but it will collapse in one direction and expand in the other direction in such a way that volume will be preserved. And the other type of motion that can happen is that, well, there's going to be an overall rotation of the sphere. And this is what this term actually. So let's try to see how that comes about. So let's look at shear. And what I'll do here is to, so I have a three-dimensional system, but I think I'll truncate it to two dimensions. So the shear the shear matrix would have, a bunch of components of sigma 1-1, sigma 1-2, sigma 1-3. Here we would repeat sigma 1-2. Sigma 2 2, sigma 2 3. Here we repeat sigma 1 3, sigma 2 3. And I want to make sure that the trace is zero. So what appears here is minus sigma 1 1 minus sigma 2 2. And if you count, we have five independent quantities here. So let me take an example where we get rid of all of them except for sigma 1 2. And I'll call it sigma 1 2. Only sigma 1 2 is not zero. So it's a specific case, but, it's good. And if I write the equation, so I'll suppose that we have here, and I'll suppose that we also set the expansion and the rotation to zero so that we focus on defect shear alone. And what I want to do is to write down the equation that we get for the component of T. In that limited case here, that special case where B is only made from the shear tensor. And if you have that situation, well, you have a very simple set of equation for the next component of C, you end up with sigma 1-2 multiplying psi y, because, it's an off-diagonal coupling. And then you have that for the rate of change of sigma y. And what appears on the right-hand side is going to tell us how the deviation vector changes as we follow that spherical shape in time. And just to make a very quick illustration of this, so suppose that we have the x-axis and the y-axis here. Suppose that my initial shape is, well, in this case, a circle. Well, you can plot the vector field that appears on the right-hand side and decide how the shape is going to change. For example, if you look at this point here on the circle, what you find here is that, well, x is going to be 1, which means that, and xy is going to be 0, which means that you're not changing the x component, you're only changing the y component. And you're changing the y component by, well, let's say a positive change. So the vector field that appears on the right side will be this at that point. And if you go through the story, and if you continue to build it like this, I just want to do it quickly because we're running out of time for this morning, and I want to complete the discussion. But if you plot the vector field on the right-hand side around the circle, you're going to find that it's here, it goes here, it goes here, and it goes like this, And you can also butt on the point 45 degrees. So it goes up here, it goes like this, it goes like that, and it goes like here. So the meaning of this is that as we follow the circle, so we've drawn that circle around here, which is the position of the reference fluid element. We follow the motion of that circle as the fluid moves in time, and we find that the shape is going to be moving according to this. And if you join the arrows, you find that the shape of the circle, oops, I didn't draw it very well, but shape has become elongated in the 45 degree direction. So it's elongated here, it's squashed in the opposite direction, and that's what we mean by shear. We change the shape of a figure without changing its volume or in this case its area. That's what shear does. So we have the expansion that corresponds to an overall expansion in the volume or contraction if theta is negative, combined with the shearing motion, and to that we have to add also rotation. So let's do it for rotation very quickly. So if we have rotation, so in this context, what I'm going to do is to set theta and the shear tensor to zero. And we're going to look at the omega matrix, which here will have three independent components. So we have omega 1, 2, omega 1, 3. Here we'll repeat omega 1, 2, but it comes with a minus sign because it's actually symmetric. Zero along the diagonal, omega 2, 3. We have minus omega 1, 3, minus omega 2, 3, and zero. And if you count, you have three independent quantities, right? So again, I'll fit the same trick. I'll only focus on the effect of those two. So I'll just assume that omega 1, 2 is not zero. And I'll repeat the equation. So in this case, we have that the deviation vector will change according to this, so we have omega 1, 2 times cy, and we have this derivative being equal to minus. And the basic difference is that here we have the same sign, here we have alternating sign, and that changes the nature of the displacement field completely. And if you repeat the same process here and look at the vector field that lives on the right side, and you evaluate it along the circle, what you're going to find is that in this case, it goes like this, all in the same direction. So what you have is a rotation of the original figure. You don't change the shape, but just globally rotate like that. That's the vertex. And in fluid mechanics, you know, that quantity right here would be associated with the curl of the velocity field. And that's what's normally called vorticity. And if you have circulation within the fluid for the vertex, well, that's what we saw act here. Here we call it rotation, but you know, it's really the same thing as the vorticity quantity in fluid mechanics. Okay, so what we've done here is to just break down. Mathematically, we've broken down the matrix in terms of irreducible quantities. But what's important about that is that we identify clearly the physical action of each term separately. This corresponds to an overall change in volume or density within the fluid element. This corresponds to a change in the shape of neighborhood, you know, a marked neighborhood of the fluid element without a change in volume. And this corresponds to a rotation also without change in volume. And we have simple separate actions for each of those terms. And general action then is going to be just, you know, a sum of those three effects. So the sum can be hard to visualize, but each term individually is easy to visualize. And that's the purpose of doing that. Here I've done it fluids. This afternoon we'll come back, and now I'll introduce confluences. But you're going to find that, you know, the description of confluences follows very similar lines. The mathematics are almost identical, except that we're going to be working in space-time instead of in the Newtonian language, where you're going to see equations that look an awful lot like this one, except that it's going to be written with Greek keys instead. Okay, so I think that's enough for this morning. Any questions? Yep.
Is that the diagram did the way you intended? Are we supposed to think of the center as
the reference fluid element and consider the set of separation vectors that are equidistant from that point.
Right, so this is the reference fluid element that bridges to the
point.
And the idea is that when you're sitting on the fluid element and you just mark a neighborhood around the fluid element by painting, so you have a spherical surface, or you have a spherical ball at the initial time around yourself, and you want to, here I've drawn it 2D, but you think of it 3D, you have the spherical ball around you, and you want to see what happens to that spherical ball as time evolves, and what happens to it is going to be determined by those equations, and you have those, you know, expansion action, the shearing action, and the rotation action.
How these elements evolve in time in the fluid mechanics point of view, where are we just going to keep that for the GR? So we're going to look at the evolution equations of shear, the evolution equations of the expansion.
That's the question. So here, I just wanted to do kinematics.
And I'm not interested in forces acting on the fluid, and therefore I would not be able to tell you why there's a shear, why there's rotation, and why there's expansion. In the conference case, we're going to be able to do a little bit better because the dynamics is dictated by the Einstein field equations, essentially. So here we're going to go a little bit deeper and actually figure out evolution equations for the quantities. So that will incorporate dynamics on top of just kinematics. So we'll get that.
I want to just get this breakdown and the usefulness of that breakdown before we get to the relativistic situation.
Other questions?
Okay,
so let's reconvene in the afternoon.